Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Hello and welcome to Elbphilharmonie Talk. This is Tom Schulz speaking on the microphone. Today I am in conversation with Jess Gillam. Jess Gillam is a saxophone player from the UK. She's very young, like 24, and she was rising star in 2020, and she is rising star again in 23, which is a bit odd, but it makes perfect sense because in 22, the rising stars that had been nominated by the concert halls all around Europe, organized in the European Concert Hall Organization, that was just an online thing. Nobody really was able to perform a year ago live. So we had a recording of Jess Gillam from England somewhere where she would play, and we distributed the recording, but we didn't present her live in this series of rising stars. So in 23 we will, which is fantastic. And time did not stand still in between January 22 and now, because it was even twice that Jess Gillam came to Hamburg to perform. One was in the summer. She was playing with the European Union Youth Orchestra, and then she was soloing with the NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchestra, with the resident orchestra of the hall. And it was on that occasion, during one of the rehearsal breaks, that we conversed a bit about her exciting life and her career and the astonishing speed she has with what she does, being so centered at the same time. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So we are sitting in the Kai Studio number 2, Jess Gillam and I, the saxophonist from England, and I welcome you. I'm very happy you are here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. You just had a rehearsal. I think it was the first big rehearsal with the entire orchestra, playing this John Williams piece where you are soloing. And what's your impression of the hall playing alto saxophone in this grand hall?
I think it's one of those halls that will never lose its awe. There are some halls, no matter how many times you walk into them or you see them, you still catch your breath. And I think it's such a space that invites collaboration, I think. In this John Williams piece, we have the trio and we have the orchestra. But I think because of the shape of it, they're almost like hug from it. It invites you to be really looking at everybody and connecting to the audience. So I'm excited for the concert.
Beautiful. And it's not a premiere for you, because you were here just in the summer, just a couple of weeks ago, with the European Union Youth Orchestra playing this John Nyman piece. Was it, what was it, the B thing?
Ah, Michael Nyman.
Michael Nyman, of course. Michael Nyman. You were playing his Where the Bee Dances, right? Which you also recorded. And I mean, you are 24, you have two records out, plus a number of EPs and little songs. You are a fast musician, I would say, in terms of moving on with your career.
Yeah, I think I've always been someone who, if I have a goal or a project, I need to do it now. And I'm trying to kind of take more time on things now as I become older. I'm 24, trying to kind of, I've been playing in public since I was 14. So after kind of 10 years of being in this cycle, you realise what a strange life it is. It's amazing to be able to share music and play with people. But also now I really want to be considerate about the things I record, the projects I do, and really have time to nurture them and to say something with them. Because now we have this kind of, everything is fast in the world. Social media, food, thinking, movement, transport, everything is about speed. But I don't think we actually, as people, want that all the time. It's a lot.
That's very true. And I mean, listening to you play and hearing how you phrase and articulate, you take your time. I mean, you're not in a rush. I mean, you really can bring the music to almost a still point whilst you're still playing and breathing, which is very beautiful, I find.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I was tempted to think, you know, when Adolf Sachs invented this instrument in the early 40s of the 19th century, he was, of course, thinking of classical music, because, I mean, that was pretty much the music of the day. And then the saxophone took a totally different turn. For the last 100 years or so, it was basically a jazz instrument. Then it came into the pop context. And you, as a young Brit, bring it back as a solo instrument to the classical world with all the bridges going to film music and these other things. I think he would be proud of you. He would say, oh, finally.
Well, thank you. I think it's really interesting. As you say, it was designed with classical music in mind, and actually as a military instrument to be played in bands. So it was very much written music and music with other people and to be loud and outdoors and compete with brass instruments. But it then was adopted by dance music and jazz music, and that's its history and has become its voice. So now I try and respect all of those traditions that it's the instrument has grown up, and it's an amazing vehicle to sit in a space that is kind of a grey area, which is where I think music and life can be really interesting, not in the black and white. This isn't classical concerto or pop music, it's the in-between, and it can do both without changing much technically.
And again, I'm tempted to delete the grey word because it's so colourful. It's not black and white. I mean, both are very colourful. And then what you are adding now and trying to bring forward is, again, different colours. I mean, as your producer puts it, you have a zest to refreshing the repertoire of the instrument. And that's true. I mean, you are covering songs, you are covering like Thom Yorke's Suspirium. What brings you to these tunes? Do you hear them and you say, I need to play this?
Yes, sometimes I hear a song and I think the saxophone could bring a new dimension or shine a different light on the melody. And with the Thom Yorke song, the melody is almost like a folk melody and his voice is an instrument in itself.
Absolutely.
So then to try and replicate that or interpret that in some way on the saxophone was fascinating. I listened so closely to all of his tiny little quivers and shakes and the way that he moves around his voice. But I think the amazing thing about the instrument is that because it has its history in being in jazz and in pop music, that can then invite an audience into the Glazunov concerto or the Villa-Lobos concerto, the pieces that maybe aren't as well known, the sounds of the saxophone that aren't as well known. But if the songs and more familiar sounds can be an indoor into the classical music world, I think that's really exciting, because quite often, I don't know how it is here in Germany, but in the UK, classical music can feel like something that isn't necessarily for a certain listener.
Yeah.
So if I can give them a bridge to come and discover that music, then the instrument offers that. I think it's really special.
So it's a kind of a seduction, probably.
Exactly.
You know, coming from familiar sounding surroundings into a world where this is just a solo instrument in a classical context. And still you think saxophone always has this appeal, you know. It is coming from the black music tradition, or has been used primarily in this context. And when in pop music, you have a different approach and a different tone color, I would say. It's not necessarily the dirt. It's not, you know, it's a bit like Supertramp or Candy Dulfer. You know, it can be very poppy and very easy listening. So it has all these big, big ranges. And you have Ornette Coleman, you know. It's massive, the range of where you can move artistically. How do you decide? What defines beauty for you? I mean, Ornette Coleman says beauty is a rare thing. What is beauty for you in music?
Wow, what a question. I think for me, the intent of something is one of the most important things in music. I think the soul of the person and hearing the soul of the artist in the music is beautiful. And you might not like that music, but when you get a window or a glimpse into the soul, that's, I think, unequivocally beautiful, because somebody has offered you a chance to be with them, even if they've never met you. Music can be the bridge between the two souls, can be the bridge between two people. And I think I hear things where I think this person is being so generous in offering us this world to live in, this symphony to live in, this song to live in. And I might not like it, but I think it's beautiful that I can exist in that world if I want to, and they've created it. And so I think intention is one of the most important things, to do it with kindness and love and a thoughtfulness for the world and people, I think that's beautiful.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And then, of course, there is also a tendency to become too sweet, too kind, too nice, too touchy, too kitschy maybe even. Mm-hmm. How do you refrain from going into that direction with your repertoire?
I think there's a very, very fine line. And I don't think that I've always... There are some things I wish I hadn't done.
Okay.
And I don't think I've always found the line. I think there's a fine line between trying too hard to put a new spin on something or to create something new out of something that's well-loved because you want to invite people into it. I think it has to be to have the intent of sharing this with somebody, you have to really believe in it yourself. So I think the first step is authenticity. And it's a word I think we seem to be hearing more and more, authenticity. And I keep thinking, what does that actually mean? And I think it boils down to the why. Why am I making this music? Is it music for the sake of music, or am I making this for people?
And so as soon as you can give an honest answer to the question,
Yes, exactly.
You're approaching authenticity.
Yeah. And I think for me, I'm really concerned with audiences and people. I do it for people. Of course, I love practicing and I love the instrument, but my main passion is sharing it with other people. And some artists are the opposite. They make the music for the music and then people enjoy it. And I think it's a funny... There's almost two approaches, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm not creating, I'm interpreting. So that's also a difference.
And it's very interesting, this conversation, because of course, the kitschy side I was just mentioning, if you are really for the people, for the, you know, for the audience, you can easily move too much towards the direction of being a crowd pleaser, rather than have this authentic self saying, you know what, this is maybe not the tune I should play. So listening to you, I find you are just reporting about a learning curve in your own decisions in terms of repertoire, right?
Yes, it's the balance between what I believe I should share with people, what I think people will enjoy, but also what I think is great music. Mm-hmm. And I think that balance, and also having to contend with lots of external opinions, record labels, management, whoever it is, and all these people have great ideas and they're all equally passionate. But then I have to kind of really believe in something to make it work. And I think I recorded my first album when I was 17, 18.
Something,
how can you know?
How can you know?
Yeah, I don't know now.
And all people are coming to you and saying, you should do this or you should do that or don't do this. And,
yeah.
And who are your closest consultants?
My dad has always been a very kind of great source of measure. He wasn't brought up in a classical music world at all. He's My Bloody Valentine, Bjork, loud guitar bands.
Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, Peter Gabriel, definitely. So he's been a source of measure of how does this sound without the kind of pre-conceptual ideas around classical music. And also I'm trying to train myself to be the person to be objective. I think that's the goal, to be able to listen to something and think, how does this sound?
Maybe you don't have to be objective, but passionately subjective.
Maybe, yeah, yeah.
Just saying, this is what I want and this is what I don't want.
Yes, and it's having the confidence to say no.
yeah. There's this very sweet scene in the EPK that Decca brought out for your second album where your dad appears in person in the studio and you converse and he's just exuberant and joyful. And I researched a bit and I saw that he is a merchant, apparently. He is working in a family business that goes back almost as far as Adolf Sachs, like in the rather late 19th century, you had this grocery store in Alfersen where you grew up. And there's some photos you can see with you and apparently your sister. So you are two of you?
Yes, two of us, yeah.
Is she also in music or does she do something totally different?
She's a songwriter.
She's a songwriter?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Is she older than you?
She's younger than me. And she is, I would say, inherently much more musical. She's got such a musical brain and can turn her hand to any instrument.
But you're not fishing for compliments here.
No, we are, but we are black and white. I will work at something for hours and hours and hours and be totally organized. And she is kind of this dreamy, creative soul, and she'll pick up a guitar and write a song, and it's there, and you just think, oh.
Do you envy her?
Sometimes.
How many years apart are you?
She's 19, so five years. Yeah.
Because I was wondering, of course, I mean, playing on that level saxophone in your age, if you are not, you know, in a rock band or in a jazz band, it needs a lot of practicing and a lot of discipline. And I wondered, I mean, you must have picked up the instrument quite early, like with 7 or 8 or so.
Yes, 7.
And what was your regimen? Would you just like rehearse 4 or 5 hours a day, like constantly?
So, yeah. When I first started, I was having group lessons. So there would be 2 or 3 of us in a room and we would learn a note, maybe 2 notes a week. And there wasn't really much structure. I was in the carnival band where my dad was the percussion teacher. And we would learn tunes mainly by ear and play them in carnivals. And it was very far away from the classical training that I then went on to have. So when I was about 11, I started having one-to-one proper, not proper lessons, the kind of more structured form
serious
of lessons. Yeah.
Lessons. But we're still within the school context?
Yeah, at school. I'd had some jazz lessons before that with a great local teacher. And then, yeah, 11, I started with the grade system, the exam system. And then when I was 13, I went to the Junior Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester in England, which was very structured and was a specialist music school every Saturday. So then my practice really started to take shape and structure, and I would be at school at 7 in the morning before school, practicing as soon as I got home. I just loved it at that age. But then, of course, you go through the ups and downs of not loving it when
puberty,
you're a teenager.
You know, yeah, wanting exactly to get away from the burdens and the discipline that's needed. Yeah.
But always I try and find that 7-year-old self or the 11-year-old self that's playfulness and the joy of playing. Because, again, with great discipline comes freedom, but the freedom can sometimes feel like it's so far away if you've lost the joy and the fun of it. So I try and pick up the instrument and just play sometimes, because it's play, it's not do, it's play,
playing,
like you play with children.
It's like not getting too serious with all of this.
Yeah.
And be very serious.
Exactly. Yeah. Balance is the hard thing.
Do you carry like a picture of yours in your saxophone coffer, you know, where you're carrying your instrument around, just reminding you of yourself, how you were, or is this just an internal thing?
No, it's internal, but that's maybe a nice idea. It might be nice to have a little picture, because sometimes it is hard to forget.
That's what I wonder, you know, sometimes you really have to search for this memory, and if you look at yourself and you see, ah, that was me.
But then a lot of it is also in the saxophone. Sometimes I look at the mechanisms of the instrument and think, this is still amazing. This is still mind-boggling.
Did the instrument, like with the violin, would grow with your hands? I mean, did you start with a smaller edition of an alto or soprano saxophone? Or was it always this big and you had to really work harder with your children's fingers?
Yeah, it was always that big.
It was always that big, see?
So I used to have a harness that went across my back to help with the weight, and my fingers were just tiny.
And you had to work hard and
really
train
hard
your fingers.
Yeah.
So that at some point must have become easier with time.
Yes.
You know, having, you know, grown up hands now and still the same size of the instrument.
And I think, I don't know when you fully stop growing, but maybe soon.
Depends.
But the dexterity becomes easier with time and also familiarity. But yeah, it was a big instrument at
That's
very age.
Interesting. That means also that maybe just because of the pure technicality of the size of the instruments, you didn't pick up the tenor.
Well, I did a little bit.
You did
when
a little
I was,
bit.
Yeah, how old would I have been? Maybe 12.
Okay.
And there was a point where I had to kind of choose whether I was going to train in jazz and really learn my jazz vocabulary and learn all the standards and be immersed in that world, or whether I wanted to play written music and classical music. Still don't think classical music is quite the right word for what I do, but that career, the two different options. And there was a point when I was about probably 12 or 13 where the tenor and the soprano represented the two worlds for me. So the soprano was going to give me this much more classical route, and the tenor the jazz. And I remember having a conversation with my mum and dad and saying, I really want to do this. And I could see my dad's face fall. You know, he'd wanted a girl who was in a rock band.
He hoped for a tenor.
Yeah. But I try and bring that sensibility to the classical music. The kind of, I think it's still possible to respect the music and bring personality. So I try and still straddle both in some ways.
Yes, and you know, there are plenty of brilliant jazz improvisers in soprano and alto too, so you're not completely losing it only because you're just refraining from playing tenor.
And I mean, some of the most amazing improvisers on soprano. I mean, you've got Coltrane.
Coltrane, of course, Steve Lacy, Wayne Shorter. I mean, you name them. I mean,
Sidney Bechet.
Yeah, Sidney Bechet to begin with. Yeah. So there are quite some role models, you could even say, in terms of, you know, how the tone quality is made and timing and these things. And I loved to hear you play, because even if it's written music, you can sense there is this, it's physical in a way. You know, when you're on stage, you're always moving a bit, and it's as if there would be an internal swing in you. And I don't mean that in a jazz historical term. It's more, the way you feel the pulse of the music and the rectangularity of the written music, you slightly are above that when you play.
That's my aim.
Cool.
That's my aim, and I'm glad you feel that in some way, because I think this black and white dots on the page, they're incredible. They are this crazy chord that we can create sounds from, but they are just dots on the page. So if we can find the essence of what's on the page and then bring that to life. And with this Williams piece, for instance, it's inspired by 50s and 60s,
totally,
you know, that kind of, so it's strange because it's written down and it wouldn't have been written down in its essence. So to bring some of its essence to the written music is the aim here.
And it is difficult. I mean, there is like bar changes all the time and 7/4s and stuff. And you really have to count, probably you had to count at some point when learning a piece, but then transcending all this and really go with it without being too rubato. Again, you know, it's really impressive.
Oh,
it's at such a young age, I find. Now, you've recorded your last solo album in 2020, right? And you have released it in 2020. Then there was all this terrible COVID stuff going on, and you couldn't perform much of it, I guess.
No.
And it's just resuming now, right? So
yes.
you have come back to performing and to playing. We spoke about the Suspirian piece of Tom York's, and there are various other, you did the Michael Nyman piece on it. And then it almost feels like eclectic, the repertoire of the record and also of the first record. Is it always your choice now to say, this is the piece I'm going to choose for my next record?
No.
Okay.
I try, there's always a balance with label and things that will, the balance between commercialism and art, and not that they can't coexist. But I'm really grateful to have a label who are open to ideas and signed a saxophone player in the first place. I mean, they'd never signed a classical player before, so it was great to have that opportunity. But also with that comes a slight pressure, I find, to make sure that the instrument is well represented,
mm-hmm.
and to try and make sure that I contribute towards its history if I can. But sometimes I try, and they are very open to ideas, but also they want it to be as popular as it can be, which is, you know, the job of a label. So it's sometimes a balance of finding the
coming back
the right
to the
things.
Dance we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, exactly. But they are great people. I love them.
Yeah. And then you have these beautiful young arrangers who are really working with these pieces that you choose, or that you choose collectively, to find an appropriate way to embed the saxophone in these songs. Again, these are people you know and you've been working with, or are they coming from the label?
A mixture. Some of them I've worked with quite a number of times, so I'll hear a song and think, okay, that person would be the best person, I think, to reimagine that, because they can write beautifully for strings, or they can make that certain colour sing. But the most exciting part for me is the commissioning, is the new pieces, and asking composers to write sometimes not with a brief, and hearing what happens, and then how that then takes on different lives on the record and then live. So the piece by Luke Howard, for instance, Dappled Light, at first that was just a MIDI demo from the computer, And you have no idea how it will feel with other people, how it will sound. And now live, it's taken on a different life, and we do it in a couple of different ways. And it's just a 4-minute piece, but you think it's something really special that has been created. He's in Australia, we're in London, and this kind of bringing people together. So it's mm-hmm. I love being able to commission new music as well.
And the way you are performing this is with your ensemble. Is this like a fixed ensemble, or are these just hired players who you love and like and love to play with?
Yeah, so with the ensemble, we have a fixed group, 8 of us, and sometimes because 8 musicians' diaries don't always align, we'll have different players come in. But I've done a couple of tours with them since we released the album now, and we have another one coming up next year, and that feels like a musical home, and that feels like playing with friends and colleagues who are equally passionate about creating the same energy on stage and being a unit of sound together. And after spending so much time on my own, travelling and being in different places, to be with 8 people who I know really well on stage, it's
comforting.
Yeah, and it's exciting as well. Because we know each other well, we can take more risks. We can second guess what they might do there. And then when you have the written music, then there's another level then of actually, we'll repeat that bit today. We'll go around, we'll add the bass. And yeah, I try and find musicians who have the same outlook. They're kind of rooted in classical, but they are from other backgrounds or have other interests, so we can try and make it work.
mm-hmm. In terms of commissions, most of these pieces seem to be rather short, almost like in a song form or not too long. And I wonder, is there an attempt being made yet to approach people like, I don't know, Esa-Pekka Salonen or one of the big shot composers of our time to compose for you like a series, like they would compose violin concertos or piano concertos, like Tom Ardes or somebody, you know, saying, listen, would that be something you would ever consider? Is this in the making, maybe?
Yes, definitely. I'm about to premiere a concerto by Anna Klein in Detroit in a few months, which will be great. But I always look in how can we, because the concerto repertoire is slight in comparison. There are gems in there, but it is slight. And that's somewhere where I think this is an exciting area where we can really
contribute to something new
and grow the sound of the instrument. So that's something I'm constantly working on, and British composers. So I'll premiere, I think, 2 or 3 concertos next year to have just, and some of them I will kind of be in touch with the composer a lot and show them what the instrument can do, and sometimes I'll say just write what you like, and depends how they work as well. And it's that moment when you receive it the first time is terrifying and exciting.
I can totally imagine. Plus, oftentimes then there is a time pressure to learn the piece in order to perform it, because then there are commissions, you know, and then they have their fixed dates when the performances are going to be scheduled, and you have to be ready by then.
Yes.
And sometimes composers really try to bring the bar as high as possible, because can you still do this? Okay, then I'll make it even a little more difficult for you to play.
And they say, oh, now the instrument is so different to 50 years ago. It can do all these things. And it's the composers. They are really pushing a lot of the time. They are amazing in finding out the limits of instruments. I think it's with the ensemble, we premiered a piece that Nico Muli wrote for us.
Oh, cool.
There was a 10-minute work, but again, this kind of knowing and loving his music, it's always interesting to me how composers write for the saxophone. And actually, not with Nico, but just generally getting away from the jazz-tinged mm-hmm. and jazz-influenced mm-hmm. type of writing, even in an orchestral concerto context, is sometimes quite difficult. So, for instance, I'll play the John Adams concerto in a couple of months, and we have the John Williams, and we have these amazing composers, but still the essence of jazz is there. And it's really interesting to me as to why and where that happens. Is it the ideas around the instrument? Is it because that's how it's most well known? But you can't imagine them writing a violin concerto in the same way. It's so
not
interesting to me. It's such a fascinating thing about how is the instrument perceived.
I mean, every now and then, I mean, people like the national guitarist, what's his name, Bryce Dessner.
Oh yes,
he would write a violin concerto which sounds like rock music almost. You know, it is super high density and very very short notes and stuff. And maybe having him working with that, or they are bringing their own upbringing into the instrument, and Maybe you should ask Arvo Pärt, somebody who is like far away from jazz and this world, to compose something for the saxophone. Maybe last question, the educational aspect of it. I'm wondering, when you perform live, are they little girls, little boys queuing up, lining up after the concert and trying to get in touch with you and being inspired by what you do? Are the figures of kids enrolling in saxophone courses, are they rising because of you?
I don't know if it's because of me, but I love to see young people in audiences, and quite often there'll be a queue afterwards. So we started a year ago, or I started playing and I saw you, or yeah, and that is great to see, and to see their passion for it as well, to see. Or sometimes I'll take old saxophone into a school and let the kids try who've never tried it, and to see that moment of their faces lighting
when
up.
When that produces sound in the tone.
Yeah, and that ray of light and excitement, that's really special. But then it's a strange feeling, because now, especially in the UK after COVID, music education is so underfunded and undersupported and not really valued in the way that it should be in the education system. So sometimes I have these feelings around, of course I want to introduce you to this instrument, but how can we ensure that you then have a path to continue? Because it's the worst thing to go into a school. They love the instrument, they try the instrument and love it, and then there's no way for them to learn it.
It's like striking a match without a pile of wood that would really catch fire then.
And we might have these projects, which are great projects to introduce kids to live music, but then if there's no through path for them, it's almost cruel, because you said, look at this amazing thing.
Yeah.
Oh, how am I going to do that? So I'm trying at the moment to take stock and think about how can I help? What can I do? And it's probably with online things and tutorials and classes and things like that, and still trying to engage young people in music. Because also we need audience members too in 50 years' time. We have to start nurturing creative minds and curious minds to want to come to a concert and come to the concert hall. And it's not about raising a generation of young players, although that would be amazing, but really people who can be citizens, musical citizens, empathetic citizens.
And who can relate intimately to this repertoire.
Yeah. Sometimes I love the idea of all these young saxophone players, and sometimes I think, oh, what will happen? You know, in 5 years' time, will your teacher still be there at your school? So I have, thoughts about how can I help.
Mm-hmm. So I wish you good luck with this endeavor too, the solo career coming up. And it's really inspiring to talk to you, because you're still so young and so mature. And that's wonderful.
Oh, thank you. It was so
nice to
meet you.
Thank you so much, Jess. Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.